I'd like to have you turn to the 16th chapter of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel 16. My good friend Bob Barnett tells me about the story of the man who was tarred and feathered and run out of town on a rail. And as they were carrying him through the streets of the city, he said to one of the men on one end of the pole, "If it weren't for the glory of the whole thing, I'd just as soon pass it up." And I think sometimes we feel that way about criticism. If it weren't for the notoriety and the acclaim that we get out of it, we'd just as soon pass the whole thing by. I'm sure some of our presidential candidates are thinking that way these days. And perhaps you're there this morning. You've been the victim this past week of some very harsh, critical comment, and you're still stinging, still hurting. If so, this is a passage of Scripture that I think does speak to you about that particular issue and how to handle criticism. 2 Samuel, as you may know, is David's book. It's the story of his long 40-year illustrious reign over the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. David had his ups and downs, and this particular chapter deals with one of the most depressing periods of David's reign. It occurs during a time when he was forced into exile by his son, Absalom. Absalom is a strange character in the Old Testament. He was David's eldest son, an heir apparent to the throne. He was a sort of rakish individual, affected a long flowing hairstyle, and had all the trappings of a prince. Insinuated himself into the hearts of his countrymen. Stood in the gateway and glad-handed all the men, kissed all the babies, and did all the things that politicians do, promised everything, tax cuts and all the things that the politicians promise. And in a short time won the hearts of the people away from David. And as it happens, at the period of time when Absalom was making his bid for the throne, David was ill for about 4 years of his life when he was quite sick, and as far as we know, near death. He alludes to that fact in one of his psalms. And during this time of weakness, Absalom, his own son, took advantage of David's weakness, won the hearts of the people, and dethroned him. And the chapters that precede chapter 16 will give you the details of that coup d'etat. In chapter 15, we're told that David gathered his mighty men around him. These were the men that had been with him while he was in exile before. When he was in the wilderness or in the desert, Judean desert, when he lived with the Philistines, many of his bodyguard, his retainers, his faithful warriors that had accompanied him during that time, had remained with him during his period of reign. These were all old men now, probably in their 60s, and yet still loyal to David. And chapter 15 records the journey out of the city, a very sad, pathetic picture as David and these old warriors make their way through the streets of Jerusalem, finally out through the gate, down through the valley of Kidron, and then up on the west side of the Mount of Olives. We're told in chapter 16 that when David had passed a little beyond the summit, behold, Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, met him with a couple of saddle donkeys, and on them were 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a jug of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "Why do you have these?" And Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride, and the bread and the summer fruit are for the young men to eat, and the wine for whoever is faint in the wilderness to drink." He came under the pretext of bringing provisions, but really what was in the back of his mind was a claim which he wanted to present for Mephibosheth's inheritance. Mephibosheth was one of the sons, one of the descendants of Saul, the king that had preceded David. And after all of Saul's family had been slain, David inquired about any descendants of Saul to whom he could show kindness. And Mephibosheth was one. And so David invited Mephibosheth to eat at his table. He virtually became a son of the king. And though there had been warfare between the house of Saul and the house of David, David showed extraordinary kindness to Mephibosheth, fed him, provided for him, clothed him, took care of him, and gave him an annual allowance, which was his to use as he saw fit. Ziba, who was his servant, as we'll see in a moment, accused Mephibosheth of disloyalty to David. saying that he'd gone over to the house of Saul, had sided with Absalom and those who were trying to unseat David. And David, because he was so accustomed to ingratitude, believed Ziba. By this time, all of his faithful friends, everyone who'd been loyal to him, had turned against him. Verse 3, Then the king said, "And where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is staying in Jerusalem. For he said, 'Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me.'" That was a lie, as we know from reading into the book. Mephibosheth was loyal to David to the end. But what a disheartening thing this was to David to hear this, because he had literally poured out his life for Mephibosheth, and now this man had turned on him. So the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And Ziba said, "I prostrate myself. Let me find favor in your sight, O my lord the king." That's an untruth, but David believed it at this point. Then in verse 5 we read that when King David came to Bahurim, "Behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, whose name was Shimei, the son of Gera. He came out cursing continually as he came." Bahurim is just over the hill, over the crest of the Mount of Olives, on the east side of that mountain. David had made his way up the western slopes and paused for a time at the summit. There was a place there where we're told in chapter 15 people worship God. It was the spot where people coming from Jericho, pilgrims coming from Jericho to Jerusalem, caught their first glimpse of the city, and they would stop there and worship God. And it was at this place that David looked back on the city, which as far as he knew, he would never see again. And then he starts over on the other side of the mountain, and as he's on the down slopes of the Mount of Olives, he arrives at Bahurim, a small town on the road to Jericho. And it's there he meets a strange little man, Shimei, who comes out continually cursing. It actually says he's coming out continually cursing, and you get the picture of this man running out, throwing rocks at David, and then running back behind some cover, and then coming out again and throwing rocks and cursing, and then he runs back behind a rock to protect himself. Verse 6, he threw stones at David, and at all the servants of King David, and all the people, and all the mighty men were at his right hand and at his left. And thus Shimei said when he cursed, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow. The term worthless is akin to our English word bum or derelict, a sort of worthless individual who sponges off of society. That's the term that Shimei used of the Lord's anointed, David, Belial. "The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. And behold, you are taken in your own evil, for you are a man of bloodshed." Now you have to realize what a terrible thing this was to do. It was actually against the law to speak evil of the king. Moses' law prohibited. Because the king was the symbol of God's rule in a nation. In a theocratic nation, that is a nation ruled by God, the king sat in the place of God. And if you spoke against the king, you were speaking against God. That's why in the so-called imprecatory Psalms, David's Psalms, which he addresses to his enemies, or he speaks about his enemies in these Psalms, and he calls down judgment on their head, he does so not because he's defending himself, but because he sees that he sits on the throne of Israel, and that is actually the place where God sits. And so any attack upon him is virtually an attack upon God. So to speak evil of the king is to speak evil of God and his program of salvation, because it was God's intention to bring salvation to the world through the kings of Judah. That's part of the promise that was given to David in the very beginning. It goes, in fact, even farther back to Abraham, that God, through the nation of Israel, would bless the world, and that through the tribe of Judah, he would bring the king, Messiah, who would be a source of blessing to the whole world. So when Shimei speaks out against the king, he's actually speaking out against God and his program to bring salvation to the world. So he's rejecting God. It's a serious thing. Here's this worthless old man, Shimei, of whom we know very little, who speaks out of pure tribal jealousy. He's angry because the tribe of Judah is on the throne instead of the tribe of Benjamin. Who belittles the king, speaks scornfully of him, throws rocks at him, does so out of all the wrong motives. And at a time when David is at his lowest point. Shimei, we know, was a despicable little man. Later, if you read on into the book of 2 Samuel this afternoon, you'll discover that when David came back from exile, as he crossed the ford of the Jordan, Shimei met him there, and in a fawning sort of way, begged for forgiveness, fell on his knees, promised undying loyalty to David. When he saw that his neck was in the noose, he changed his tune. And much later, Solomon had to execute him because of his treachery to Solomon and the threat that he was to Solomon's throne. So he's really a despicable, shameful man. You can understand then Abishai's point of view in verse 9. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head." Abishai was David's nephew. He was the son of David's sister, Zeruiah. And he was one of David's mighty men. He had come to David's side when David was fleeing from Saul and had fought alongside him, fought both against the Philistines and with the Philistines. He was a violent man. In fact, he's best known in the Bible for having killed 300 men. He had 300 notches on his spear, I suppose. And he was a cruel, vicious, violent man. As were his two brothers, who were likewise the sons of Zeruiah. And these are the ones that David refers to in verse 10 when he says, "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah?" As the whole family had this violent streak. Now what David is doing in this statement is separating himself from the viewpoint of these men. It sounds harsh, translated over into English, "What have I to do with you?" But it's the same idiom that Jesus uses at the wedding at Cana when he says to his mother, "What is there between you and me?" It's simply a way of disassociating yourself with the point of view of someone over there. He's saying, I don't buy that approach. And he makes a division between the solution that Abishai proposes and the solution which David himself feels most comfortable with. Verse 10. "What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, 'Curse David,' then who shall say, 'Why have you done so?'" Then David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my son who came out from me seeks my life. How much more this Benjamite? Let him alone, and let him curse, for the Lord has told him." Let him alone, and let him curse, because the Lord has told him. "Perhaps the Lord will look on my sin," literally. The word that's translated affliction here should be translated sin. It's the word in the Old Testament, aven, which is always translated sin. For instance, in the book of Hosea, when Hosea is rebuking the idolatry that was taking place in Bethel, a name which means the house of God, by means of a wordplay, he infers you're actually worshiping at Beth Aven, and that's the way it's translated in our English Bibles, Beth Aven, the house of sin. In other words, he's saying to Jeroboam, "You call this God's house, I call it a house of sin, a house of ill repute, if you please. You're saying this is God's city, I'm calling it Sin City." And so he uses the word Aven, and that's the word that occurs here, and it means sin, not misfortune or affliction. "Perhaps the Lord will look on my sin and return good to me instead of his cursing this day." So David and his men went on the way, and Shimei went along on the hillside parallel with him. And as he went, he cursed, and he cast stones, and he threw dust at him. And the king and all the people who were with him arrived weary, and he refreshed himself there. That is, at Bahurim. He'd been on his way into this little city. Shimei came out, met him on the way, pelted him with rocks, followed him all the way into the city. David goes into the city, sets up his tent, and he refreshes himself there. And for all I know, this mean, ornery little man is standing outside his tent, still throwing rocks, still jumping up and down and screaming. But it says that he refreshed himself there. Now that's an interesting story, and I'll bet that most of you have never read that story, or if you have, it's been a long time, or you've forgotten. What can we learn from this account? Well, there are two or three things that strike me, and I just say this by way of observation, and I'm sure you can find other things in the passage. The first thing that strikes me is that criticism inevitably comes when we least need it. Have you noticed that? At the time when you're most in need of affirmation, you want someone to put their arms around you and say, I love you, I really care for you. That's the time when they're critical of you. It never fails. And certainly that was David's experience. If there was ever a time when David needed support and encouragement, it was now. He'd been dethroned, he'd been driven from his city is called the city of David, remember? Driven out with his men, and one after another, some of his loyal men had forsaken him, were untrustworthy. He was hurting. And this little man starts pelting him with rocks, cursing at him. That's the way it goes. Invariably. Some of you women, on the days that are most difficult for you, when the kids are giving you the gears, and it's just been a hard day all the way around, and you feel kind of frizzy and frumpy at the end of the day, and your husband comes home and he says, you know, hon, I think you're picking up a little weight. That's the last thing you need. What you want is a word of encouragement. Or you men, you're having a hard time with your job, and that's the day that your boss picks to read you the riot act, rake you over the coals for something you've done. And the list of illustrations is endless, because we've all been there. The very time that we are most in need of affirmation and support is the time that we generally don't get it. Criticism comes when you least need it. Secondly, it almost always comes when you least deserve it. At least you think so. It comes at a time when you've begun to make amends for some wrong, when you've begun to correct something that you know is wrong and you've been feeling guilty about it, so you start correcting it and you're working as hard as you can to set things right, and then someone will criticize you for the thing you were doing last week that you were doing wrong that you think you're correcting now. It never fails. You see, David didn't deserve this criticism. There were times when David was given to violence and bloodthirst. He was a violent man. But he was never guilty, never had blood guilt in regard to Saul's family. If anything, he'd been over backwards, because he had the same view of the theocracy that the prophets had. It was God's representative. He never touched God's representative. Did everything he could to protect Saul, even from his own loyal bodyguard. And he'd shown extraordinary kindness to Mephibosheth. So he wasn't deserving of this criticism at all. And I think that's why it's interesting that these two accounts, Ziba coming and misrepresenting Mephibosheth, and this attack on him with reference to the house of Saul, the alignment of those two passages is interesting. Because he was probably just thinking, on his way into Zeruiah, how disloyal of Mephibosheth when I have shown him such loyalty, and then Shimei, accuses him of disloyalty to the house of Saul. You can see how it works. He didn't deserve the criticism. Nevertheless, he received it. The third thing I note is that criticism seems to always come from people who are least qualified to give it. People who don't understand us, who haven't been where we've been, who haven't struggled where we've struggled. They're thinking theoretically, not in terms of the practice of the situation. They're standing from afar and throwing rocks and blaming us for doing things, and we're trying our best to correct the situation. They're not qualified. And certainly Shimei, of all men, was not qualified to correct the Lord's anointed. The fourth thing I observe is that criticism frequently comes in a way that's least helpful. I suppose if Shimei had gone into David's tent that evening and put his arm around him and said, David, I think there are some things that I need to tell you about your treatment of the house of Saul. I'm sure you weren't aware of what you were doing, but I should perhaps bring you up to date on some of the atrocities that have been committed. And it might be easier for David to respond to that sort of criticism, but it's a little hard to respond to rocks and sticks and stones and cursings, violence. You know the old adage, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words never hurt me. That's not true. Words do hurt. They hurt far more than sticks and stones. And I'm sure the thing that dug into David's spirit, it wasn't the stones. It was his words. Harsh, unloving, carping kind of criticism. That's what hurts. And it would be nice if all criticism was constructive and done in a gracious way, but generally it's not. Now the thing I want you to notice is David's response to Shimei. He doesn't retaliate. He doesn't defend himself. He will neither defend himself nor will he allow anyone else to defend him. He just takes the abuse, all the abuse that Shimei can deal out. And I believe he does so for two reasons. Number one, he clearly saw the hand of God in this event. Recall what he says? If he curses, God has told him to. Isn't that amazing? Can you say that about the person who's on your back this morning? The employer who chewed you out this past week? The husband who had some harsh word of criticism to address to you? The high school, college-age person whose parents got all over him this past week for something he did unwittingly? You see the hand of God in that? David does. God is speaking through this man. He clearly saw that God was in everything, even the great tragedies of life. That's the message of both the Old and New Testaments, that God's in everything. And a truly mature person can see that. He sees God's hand even in the great calamities of life. Isaiah goes so far as to say that God creates calamity. He's the ultimate cause behind everything that happens to us. We know from the book of Job that Satan is at work too, and certainly in the case of Job, the destruction of his home and his family and his livelihood came from Satan. We know that. But when Satan reported to God, God said to Satan, "You moved me against my servant Job." It's God who takes the ultimate responsibility. How often I've said, when I've been criticized, well, I just have to consider the source. And I don't realize what I'm saying. I'm thinking, that person's not qualified, and therefore I'll not listen. But what I forget is that the ultimate source of that criticism is God Himself. And there's something about me that He wants to correct. It may not be that specific thing. The criticism may be unjust, but it may be that defensive, retaliatory spirit, that tendency to fly up in my own defense at a moment's notice, or some other area of my life that God is trying to get at. And therefore I need to see that behind that criticism, behind that foul mouth, that cheap shot, whatever it was that you experienced this past week, is the hand of God. That's God working on you. And He's the ultimate source of that criticism. And therefore, you can't take it lightly. You can't brush it off. You can't forget it. You need to take it seriously. The second thing that I see about David's response is that he relies upon God's defense. God will defend him. Not himself. He could very well have taken things into his own hands. Certainly Abishai could have dispatched Shimei in a moment's notice. Or David could have. There's no weakling. But he passes over the opportunity to defend himself or to retaliate in any way, and he relies upon the Lord to take care of it, to defend it, to minister to his needs. Notice verse 12. "Perhaps the Lord will look upon my sin and return good to me instead of his cursing this day." You see what David recognizes? He realizes that he is sinful. You see, the thing that makes us critical, or makes us respond the wrong way to criticism, is that we do recognize that we're sinful. We're vulnerable. We're weak. And we don't like to be shown up for what we are. And therefore, when someone says, "You sin," we fly to our own defense. "No, I don't sin." Because we want to cover up. We want to look good. Protect ourselves. David recognizes that he cannot defend himself. He could never look good, no matter what he did. He can't defend himself. Only God can. It's God who's justified us. It's God who's declared us righteous. It's God who accepts us the way we are, even with our sin, and therefore we can relax in our sin. We can be comfortable with it. Not that we have to go on sinning, but the fact that we fail shouldn't threaten us. God accepts us, and therefore we don't care what other people think. And therefore when they criticize us, instead of trying to defend ourselves, we can let God defend us. And we know from the subsequent history of David's reign that God did defend him. restored him again to his glory. Shimei's mouth was shut. David was vindicated. God did it. And even in that situation, I believe, right there in Bahurim, where it says he refreshed himself, there's an indication that even there, he took heart in the Lord, rested on God's ability to set things right. Whenever we go out and try to repair all the damage that's been done, invariably we make a worse mess of things. Have you ever noticed that? Someone criticizes us, and so we go around and explain to somebody else what we did, and then we have to explain our explanation, and then we explain to somebody, and we start writing letters, and then before too long we're posting notices, and it gets absurd. It just makes it worse. We can't defend ourselves. Don't defend yourself. You can make an explanation, but don't get defensive. And I know that up here, when it comes down to facing situations, I'm just as defensive as you are. But we shouldn't defend ourselves. Let God defend us. He does it so much better. He sets everything to rest. We can rest there in His ability to set things right. That's what Jesus did in the passage that was read to us earlier. Peter says that Jesus, when He was reviled, did not revile, but He committed Himself to the one who is able to judge justly. He was charged with every sort of sin and impropriety you could name, and yet he didn't defend himself. He committed himself to the one who judges justly. I remember years ago, we had a series of leadership breakfasts here, and Doug Coe from Washington, D.C., and Jim Hiskey and a number of other men came out from the East Coast and were here leading us in these evangelistic breakfasts for the leadership for the our civic leadership. Some of you, I'm sure, will remember these breakfasts. The team was staying in one of the nice hotels in our area. They were living there, and the hotel very graciously had given them a room in which to meet. But because the food wasn't too good in the hotel, and because it was cheaper across the street, they were going to a hotel across the street to eat. And one day, a number of us were standing in the lobby of this hotel, and the hotel manager came across the lobby, and you could tell from the way he approached Doug that he was very angry. He was red in the face, steam was coming out of both ears. And he said, "Mr. Coe, I understand your men have been eating across the street," and he got very abusive and very angry, and he carried on a tirade for a minute or so about how unfair that was, since they had given room for them to meet in and other benefits. Doug looked at him for a moment when he was through, and he said, "You know, you're right. You're absolutely right. We've been handling this thing wrong, and I want to apologize. And as far as I'm concerned, from now on we'll eat here in the hotel." And of course the guy was just blown right off his feet. He didn't know what to say. And I thought at the time, that's a beautiful illustration of a soft answer turning away wrath, but more than that, it was an illustration of meekness, because that's what non-defensiveness is. It's meekness. He didn't defend himself. If that had been I would have had 14 reasons why that hotel had failed to fulfill its responsibilities, and that's why we were eating across the street. But he didn't defend himself. He accepted. See, there's a man who's comfortable with his sin. He knows he fails. He knows he's weak. He knows he makes mistakes. He doesn't do everything right all the time. And so he lets God defend him. He doesn't have to defend himself. Well, that's what I think we learn from Shimei. Criticism is bound to come, and it's bound to come from people that we don't respect, and it generally comes when we don't need it in ways that we find hard to receive. And yet we don't need to defend ourselves. We can see that this is God speaking to us in a very direct way to get our attention and to make us more like His Son, Jesus Christ. And in the meantime, we can rely upon Him to defend us. Let's stand together and pray, shall we? Gracious Father, we long to be as David was in this circumstance. Quiet and restful, reliant upon You and Your ability to set things right. It's the desire of our heart. And we ask that You would teach us that and help us to see that you're at work in all affairs of life to perfect us, and that you're the one who's able to exceed every expectation that we have, and who can defend us so well. And we rest in that. And thank you for it. In Christ's name. Amen.